From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One interviewer was so intrigued by the fact that Catherine Hayhoe is both a practicing Christian and a climate scientist, she said she was like a unicorn. And Hayhoe recognizes the perception, but she doesn't believe science and religion have to be mutually exclusive. In fact, she says the spiritual part of her drives her own efforts to do something about climate change. She sees it as a moral issue, and so she spends a good amount of her time not only convincing fellow Christians about the physical reality of a warming planet, but connecting the science to their values. Hayhoe says the mandate of Christianity can be applied to climate change, so in that sense, the solution is, at least in part, love. Catherine Hayhoe is in Utah this week. She'll join us today after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of the things Catherine Hayhoe has noticed over the years is that politics has gotten in the way of faith when it comes to climate change. Hayhoe is a celebrated climate scientist and a Christian. She attends an evangelical Bible church in Texas where she lives, and her husband is a pastor. So she has the credentials in both worlds. And over the years, she's been trying to make the religious case for believing in and doing something about climate change because she says it's not about politics, it's about facts and figures and thermometer readings and history and reality. Catherine Hayhoe is in Utah this week. Today in the program, she's joining us to help us understand how religion fits into this picture because she sees God in everything, the weather included. In her book, she says God has set up a system where hurricanes can wipe out cities, but also where humans can alter the balance of the planet. So in that sense, it's not God's fault, she says, when it comes to climate change. We are the authors. Catherine Hayhoe is an atmospheric scientist. She's the director of the Climate Science Center and an associate professor in the political science department at Texas Tech University. Along with her husband, Pastor Andrew Farley, she co-authored the book called A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. They're putting together a new edition, which is coming out in just a few weeks. And we should mention she's in Utah as the guest of the Utah Interfaith Power and Light. It's a nonprofit that works with faith communities and climate issues. And she's speaking in Salt Lake City and in Logan, and we'll give you the details about that a little bit later in the program. Catherine Hayhoe, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin. I want to begin in Colombia, and we should set this up in the sense that your folks, your parents, were missionaries.
Yes.
And so you traveled to Colombia.
We did
with them when you were a kid. You spent a lot of time in Colombia, it seems.
We moved there when I was nine, and then we're there for a few years back and forth. My dad came home to do his PhD in science education.
Wow!
And then went back down again until it was time for university. So I got the science and the faith, both sides, from a young age.
So you've always had that connection. You've never seen them as being contradictory, I guess?
No, science was presented to me, first of all, as the most fascinating and cool thing that anybody could ever possibly study, yeah. Which of course it is. But it was also presented to me as entirely compatible with our faith in that studying science was trying to figure out what God was thinking when he put this whole thing together in the first place.
You grew up in Toronto. You're a Canadian.
Yes.
And this is a big question that I wondered about, and that is, I hope this doesn't sound terribly offensive, but is the Christianity in Canada a different brand than the Christianity in America? In the sense that, I mean, I think there's a natural suspicion among some American Christians with the idea of religion. And we're going to talk through all of this because you write about this. But does the same sort of suspicion exist in Canada, for example? I mean, is it a different brand of faith in some ways, do you think?
Yes. Well, first of all, let me say, if you think that's offensive, you need to come to a couple of the talks I give. That's nothing.
Okay, good.
No, I think that it is completely different. In fact, I would venture so far as to say in some instances here in the United States, we have confused our politics with our faith.
That's not so much the case in Canada, for example.
Not as much, but here's the interesting thing.
Yeah.
So kind of putting the puzzle pieces together, we've seen this tremendous political polarization happen here in the United States over the last few decades. One of the main causes of that polarization, fascinatingly, is the fact that we now have access to congenial media, to media that says exactly what we already agree with. There is a host of media out there at our fingertips, literally, on our smartphones, on the computer, on the radio, on the television. When I grew up, we had, you know, one news program in Canada that everybody watched, The National. That's just what you watched.
And
you know?
We trusted them, right?
You trust them as impartial, fair judges. Nowadays, we have a plethora of news programs and we watch whichever one we agree with. So things are starting to change in Canada, too, thanks to satellite television, where we can now access people saying exactly what we are already predisposed to accept, rather than a careful balancing of the facts. So things are starting to change in Canada, but in the United States, it's been like that for a bit longer.
One thing that you've talked about was, in an interview, you said that in the U.S. and Australia, too, you mentioned, those two countries are so individualistic that it doesn't quite yet have the idea of a common good ingrained into its culture, not in the way that you grew up in Canada with.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Would you explain that?
I don't think it's any accident that the United States and Australia are the two countries where opposition to the idea of climate change being real and needing to do something about it are strongest. And these are both countries where people moved to get away from government, to get away from oppressive legislation and taxes. And here we have a problem. We have to be totally honest about this. We have a problem that is a tragedy of the commons. So in other words, individual actions will never be sufficient to address this problem. We require collective action. And for some people, that's anathema.
Why is it anathema, this idea? Isn't that what religion is supposed to be about? Isn't that a central idea in the New Testament, this idea that you be one with God, you be one as a body of Christ?
Mm-hmm. It is, and that's why I think our faith is the solution to this, not our politics. It's our politics that are dividing us. But our faith is consistent in saying, care for others, love others, look at what is happening to your neighbors. Care for them. Care for the world that God has created and given us responsibility for. That is a unifying message rather than a divisive message.
In Colombia, because one of the messages that you, and we'll get back to this as we go, but one of the messages you mentioned is that this idea of love for, you know, fellow humankind is one of these crucial mandates of the gospel of religion, and that's one thing that's why when millions, hundreds, possibly millions of displaced people because of climate change, that's
hundreds of millions.
Mm-hmm. So that makes sense in that way. But when did this first? I mean, where you first saw this on the ground, that is vulnerable people, was that in Colombia? Like first time you started to encounter this Christian ideal in a real way?
Yes. I mean, growing up in, you know, in a big city, in a middle-class family, you don't really experience the vulnerability that we as humans have to issues like flood and drought and storms. So moving to Colombia, where, you know, some of my friends lived in houses made of bamboo or cardboard tide boxes, they would work all week and bring home 10 bricks. And when they built a wall, they would have a party and serve us all warm Coke, and we would all go and have that party because having one brick wall meant so much when that storm comes. Seeing landslides that just, you know, wipe away tens of thousands of people at a single stroke, it really brought home the fact that most people in the world live in these circumstances, in very precarious circumstances. And we know that flood and drought and hurricanes and storms are part of life on this planet. But we also know today that climate change is increasing the risk of many of these events. And so we are putting more people at risk today than would have been 100 years ago because of the choices we've made as a society.
Did you, I wonder, was there ever a time when in your experience deciding to be a scientist, studying, and I think a lot of people go through this, mm-hmm. where they kind of ditch religion for a while. Did you ever ditch the idea of God for a time? I mean, did the idea of, in atheism, or did you ever And did you come back to it? I don't know your story, and maybe that's too personal.
Well, that's no, again, trust me. If you think that's okay, too, okay. It's gotten a lot worse. Well, I think in university, that's the time when most of us really open our minds.
Yeah.
That's the time when we take out our set of beliefs, our values that were ingrained in us as children, and we look at them and we say, does this make sense? And that's an important part of becoming an adult. If we don't do that, if we don't take the opportunity to do it, who knows, it might happen much later in life at a much more inconvenient time.
Yeah.
So that's part of why I think education is such an amazing thing. But of course, I'm a little biased.
Yeah.
What I had a tremendous advantage. Like I said, I grew up with a father who was a science educator. My grandmother, although her career was her eight children, she had a degree in science education also. Mm-hmm. And my great-grandmother was one of the first women to graduate from McGill University in Canada. So I had this long tradition of esteeming education, but also esteeming our faith. So I grew up with the idea, and I only realize how lucky I am now, looking back, that whenever we see an inconsistency between science and faith, it's because we don't fully understand either one or the other. And the answer is not to dig a trench and to start fighting. The answer is to learn more and maybe open our eyes a bit more. Maybe we don't quite understand what we thought our faith was saying. Maybe the science is not as solid as we thought, and new revelations could be made in another 10 or 20 years.
Yeah.
But to advance with humility and with an idea that these are not incompatible. They are compatible. And if they seem incompatible, we just haven't figured it all out yet. And that served me in tremendous stead. But I certainly enjoyed taking classes like faith and physics, learning about what cosmologists think about the beginning of the universe and what implications that has for our view of God. I love doing that in university.
You had to convert your husband to the idea of climate change, if I get this right. Now I mentioned him as he's a pastor, but he's also a linguist. I mean,
yeah,
also a scientist too. In
yes,
many ways, right?
He's a social scientist. Yes, yeah. He does experiments, statistics.
Yeah.
He's a professor at the university.
But was skeptical.
Well, here's the thing. So this is the Canadian versus American difference, right? So I grew up in Canada and in Colombia. And, you know, I certainly did my share of cross-border shopping because that's what Canadians do,
right.
Going to
so
Florida.
We go there for prescriptions. You come here for clothes.
Yeah, right, okay, exactly.
Okay.
Although we do have outlet malls now.
Yeah, okay.
But until I moved to the States for graduate school, I moved to University of Illinois to graduate school, I had never met anybody who didn't think climate change was real. It was not even on my radar that that was an issue. In Canada.
Not even in your faith community.
No.
Wow.
In Canada, you know, the sky is blue, the grass is green, climate change is real, and we all care about air pollution. You know, I mean, that's just the way it is. Mm. So, and then here's my husband, who grew up in Virginia. His dad was a lawyer and a Republican politician, part of the Moral Majority. He grew up going to a Baptist school. Mm. Smart guy, PhD in linguistics. Endowed chair at the University of Notre Dame at the age of 27.
Gosh.
He had never met a Christian who shared his faith who did think climate change was real. And because of our mutual naivete, so to speak, we never even thought to bring it up before we got married.
Really?
Yes.
This is kind of a big deal.
Well, you know, when you're doing your graduate work, you're just buried so far into the weeds. So he knew I was doing like the chemistry of methane and my program failed and my thesis got lost. And, you know, he knew all that. But it wasn't until after we got married that we had the conversation. And it was just this complete mutual shock.
Yeah. That's amazing. How hard of a sell was he?
Well.
Wait, no. Wait, and was he influenced by, as some American Christians are, apparently, the politics part? I mean, was that part of the obstacle for him? Was that politics had gotten away in the way of faith for him in this case?
Well, it's gotten to the point where we've really been told that we can't be who we are and think it's real. So he really felt, you know, you can't be a Christian and think that this is real.
Wow.
This isn't something that Christians believe. And he's a smart guy. And studies have shown, and my husband certainly bore this out, that people who don't think climate change is real often have a lot more reasons to support why they don't than people who do. So they actually have more, you know, facts and information that they've gathered. And so, of course, with the internet, you know, my husband pulled every argument you could imagine. And when he ran out, he pulled his friends for arguments. So it was a crash course for me in why do I even think this is true? And it was great because When you go to school, when you go to university, even when you do your PhD, you learn so much detail. But this forced me to step back and say,
be really basic.
Yeah. I mean, here's a smart person who doesn't think this is real, and I love him and I want to be with him. So we got to work this out. Let me actually look at these things and take an honest look and see if it makes sense.
The idea that it's political really came fairly clear to you. This was back in 2012, and there's this stir that happened when Newt Gingrich is writing this book, or he's updating a book that he had written about the environment and politics. And someone asked you to write a chapter,
mm-hmm.
which you did.
Yes.
He ends up dropping the chapter for political reasons, I guess, which you understand now. You were a little miffed about it at the time, I guess. But did this give you, talk about this experience, if you would, and that what you, I mean, did you realize how intense it was going to be? Because it got fairly intense for you. I mean, you got a lot of pretty ugly hate mail during mm-hmm. that time. Would you talk about that experience?
Sure. Well, first of all, as a climate scientist, any time that we stick our heads out of the ivory tower of academia, we risk getting pot shots taken at it. So whether we go to speak to our kids' school and some parent hears about it and doesn't like it, if we write an editorial in our local newspaper, if even if we release our latest scientific study and the university communications office says, hey, would you like to talk to a reporter about this? Any time we lift our heads off of our computer and tell people climate change is real, it's serious, and we need to make good choices now, we will be attacked. And that's the sad reality of the world we live in. So before that whole situation with the presidential primaries, there had been several waves of attacks before that.
Yeah.
One time I was on the O'Reilly Factor, and the next day I opened my email to just, you know, check it before I went to a National Academy of Sciences meeting. I had 200 hate mails to my university email address. So this had already been going on. But the presidential primaries reach a whole new level of intensity. And what happened was Gingrich got asked in a town hall meeting by a reporter.
This was in Iowa. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. What about this chapter by this woman who's a climate scientist? Never mind that I'm a Christian. Never mind that, you know, that I'm conservative, that my husband's Republican, that he's a pastor. Never mind all that. Climate is enough to just, you know, push you under the bus. So there was a tremendous outcry and a lot of very negative pushback to the point where I really sympathize not just with my colleagues, but with people in other areas who are viciously attacked for just trying to stand up and say what's true.
But did that ever make you think, sorry, forget
yeah.
it. I'm just going to go back into my ivory tower. I mean, you know what I mean? Did that make you think, what's the point of this?
I tell you, I definitely had a moment like that because around that same time, I was reading this book called The Climate Cover-Up. And I also read The Merchants of Doubt. Now, The Merchants of Doubt just came out as a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if people haven't seen it, go see it. It's really interesting. It basically pulls the curtain away, just like The Wizard of Oz, pulls the curtain away and shows you who is behind the curtain whispering, climate change isn't real, into our ears. But the book that really depressed me was The Climate Cover-Up. It was written by a guy called Jim Hogan, who is a longtime PR expert. And he basically laid out the manual on PR techniques over the last century and showed how every single one of those techniques has been successfully used to confuse us and to stop us on climate change. And when I read that book, I just felt like, what is the point? I felt like, you know, in World War II, the Polish cavalry fighting the German tanks. Like, what is the point?
But you plowed ahead. Why?
I did, because I went back to my research and I looked at what it's telling me. And what I do is I specifically study what climate change means to us and the places where we live. So if we live in Salt Lake City, what are the things we care about? We care about our air quality. We care about our water. We care about our snowpack. We care about the integrity of the place where we live. And when we look at the place where we live, it is changing. With our own eyes, we can see what's happening to the air quality. We can see what's happening to our snow. We can see the changes here. And so when I look at what the future holds and when I look at how the door is closing every year that we go without making any good decisions to reduce our carbon emissions and to prepare for future change, every year that we go, that door closes more and more. But we have an opportunity now to make a difference. There's a huge difference between what happens in the future if we continue on our current pathway versus what happens if we make smart choices now. And when I look at that, it's like a doctor. You know, you go to the doctor and the doctor sees something happening in your body and the doctor says, you have two choices. You can change your lifestyle now and you will lead a long, happy, successful, fulfilled life. Or you can do nothing and you will end up on the operating table with a possibly fatal illness. I mean, how could the doctor not speak out?
Catherine Hayhoe is with us. She is an atmospheric scientist, co-author of the book, A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions, which she's updating. It's going to be out, new version, in a couple of weeks. You're giving 99-cent versions of the book. You want to say something about that?
Sure. Do not buy the book on Amazon now because the first edition is going for ridiculous prices and I don't get that money. But as soon as we have the e-version out, it's going to be on Nook and Kindle and all the rest, and we're going to make it available for 99 cents for as long as we can, because the point here is not to make any money. The point is, hey, if you need this information, this is the best gift to Uncle Joe that you'll ever find.
Catherine is in Utah as a guest of the Utah Interfaith Power and Light, and other sponsors, including the Nature Conservancy. Tonight at 7 o'clock, she's speaking at the First Presbyterian Church in Salt Lake City. Tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock, she's going to be giving a talk at the Logan LDS Tabernacle. She's going to be back in Salt Lake for another talk on Thursday. You can get all of the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, this question: why is it that less than a third of evangelical Christians believe the planet is getting warmer? Catherine Hayhoe is a believer of two things. She's an evangelical, but she's also a climate scientist, and she believes humans are making this climate change. What she doesn't believe, though, is that science and religion are mutually exclusive, and she's trying to convince her fellow Christians that there is a way to have it both ways, that is, to believe in God and the Bible, even creationism, and yet still see the realities of climate change. Today in the program, she's joining us to make the religious case for the environment. She's here, by the way, as a guest of an organization, the Utah Interfaith Power and Light, giving a speech tonight, tomorrow. She's back on Thursday. We'll give you details about that as we go along. You say in your book that you wrote with your husband that the idea grew out of the questions that you were getting from people who wanted the quote-unquote truth. And they wanted it from someone they could trust, which really gets to this kind of natural suspicion that's out there. Because you say in the book, Christians are naturally suspicious of people who believe differently. And this is how you put it in the book. You say, how can people who have such different ideas about, you know, about marriage and family and the sanctity of life, how can they have anything worthwhile to say? First of all, there's this natural suspicion that you have to get out of the way before you can talk about that, I guess.
There is. And in fact, this past year, they polled the entire United States to figure out which are the most politically polarized issues in the U.S. So which are the issues where Democrats and Republicans are furthest apart?
Yeah.
Number one issue is obviously the performance of the president. Otherwise, why are you Democrat or Republican?
Yeah.
Number two, climate change. Number four, do you trust scientists? So yes, that is a huge issue. Here's the funny thing, though. Scientists have a certain reputation as being atheist or agnostic, denying the reality of God. One of my favorite people is a woman called Elaine Eklund. She is a sociologist, which means she studies people. Makes me a little nervous to be around her. I always feel a bit like a lab rat.
She's studying.
Yeah, like she's taking notes.
Yeah.
But she does some amazing research on scientists and faith. And what she has found completely contradicts conventional wisdom. The majority of scientists are spiritual people and view spirituality as an important part of who they are. Now, there aren't that many scientists who would call themselves evangelical Christians, for example.
Sure.
But that's mostly because, honestly, we don't feel very welcome in most evangelical churches. And when you look at evangelicals, as you referred to, about a third of them say climate change isn't real. But here's the thing. When you do the research and you account for political affiliation and ideology and even age, the religious bias drops out. So it isn't really coming from our evangelical faith. It's coming from what our thought leaders are telling us. The number one predictor of what we think about climate change is who we trust to give us information on issues like immigration, gun control, all kinds of issues, including climate change. Yeah. Who do we trust? Who do we listen to? That is the predictor of what we believe.
Because we're cognitive misers.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Explain that. We only have so much energy.
So much brain power.
So much brain power. And so we need to find someone to trust.
Yes. I mean, they say the last true Renaissance man was Francis Bacon. I mean, that at that point right. in the world, that was when the human brain could contain all the information known. But I kind of doubt even that.
Right.
I mean, that was a very Western-centric view. But so, I mean, you and I mean, I fully acknowledge I'm a cognitive miser. I do not have all the time to figure out what ISIS or ISIL is, what they are doing, what their agenda is, what we should do about it. What do? I read and I listen to people I trust to have an opinion about it. So we do exactly the same thing about climate change. But here's the problem. When we look at what people are telling us, we realize that we're getting a lot of false information. In 2013, on CNN, 30% of the information on climate change was false. On Fox News, over 70% was false. But it was better than the previous year. That was over 90%.
You mention in the book that there are quote-unquote legitimate reasons why Christians have hesitated about climate change, and I wanted to work through a couple of these. Evolution is one of those reasons. Some Christians believe climate change means that you, as you point out in the book, if you believe in climate change, then you have to believe in evolution, and you have to believe in, for example, that the Earth is, you know, 4 billion years old and all the other things that come along with that. But you say climate change is fully understandable without ascribing a birth date to planet Earth.
Yes. It's natural to think that because, first of all, who's telling us about climate change? It's scientists. And who's telling us about evolution and the age of the Earth? Scientists, too. Second of all, ice core data, which goes back hundreds of thousands of years, is one of the main tools scientists often use to explain climate change to people. When we were writing this book together, though, my husband said, why don't you make a plot of the Earth's temperature and of carbon dioxide over the last 6,000 years. I said, well.
In other words, within the confines of Christian believers. Some.
Some.
Yeah.
Some.
Yeah.
Again, not in Canada. I had never met anybody, but when I moved to the States, yes. Yes. And my husband, in fact. I said, sure, I've never done that before. There's no scientific reason to, but let's do it and see what it looks like.
Right.
I have to tell you, it looks amazing. In fact, if people go to my Facebook page, I put a copy of it up there. You can see. We were on a long, slow, downward slide into the next ice age until the Industrial Revolution. And then temperature just goes, boom, straight up. So in fact, I think that the human fingerprint of climate change is far more clear and far more discernible over just the last 6,000 years. So honestly, we don't have to agree that the world is any more than about 300 years old to agree that humans are changing climate, and we all agree on that.
See, this is so interesting because I think a lot of people think, scientists, your belief in evolution is a deal breaker. And you don't seem to, you have such a sense of urgency. You're like, you know what, we can fight about that later. Is that it?
Exactly, yeah. Yes. We have all the time in the world to figure out this evolution thing. It does not immediately affect our lives and our well-being today. But with climate change, we do not have all the time in the world. We have a very limited amount of time. And like I said, that door is closing every year that goes by without doing something. So we have to find as many points of agreement as we can to fix this issue now. And then we have all the luxury of time to work on the other issues that divide us.
I hope this isn't too much of a diversion, but can you just give me a sense of how it is you do fit your spiritual, religious worldview into the idea of evolution? Or do you even want to talk about that?
That's a bit of a tangent. But in general, though, I would say that this is actually really cool. One of my favorite verses in the Bible is Hebrews 11:1. It says that faith is the evidence of what we do not see, what is not here and now. Science is exactly the opposite. Science is the evidence of what is here and what we see and observe. And in fact, if you Google the definitions of faith and science, just go to Google, that's exactly what it says too. Science is observable. It is here, it is now, it is present. It is what is inside this universe. But we know that there's more to it than just that. What's outside this universe? Why do we exist? why do we humans even have these urges that we do that run contrary to what evolution says that we would, survival of the fittest? You know, so that there's more to it than what science can tell us, but they're totally compatible with each other. They're not two different religions, as we so often assume them to be.
So your idea of religion, your own cosmology is pretty expansive, because we have a pretty limited human idea of what we even know about this idea of a god or of a universe. Is that right?
It's kind of like the elephant and the blind man, right?
Yeah.
You know, back in the Middle Ages, we had a pretty good grasp on the tail of the elephant. And now, you know, in our hubris, we might feel like we have a picture of the whole elephant, but we might be missing a total appendage somewhere. So
I want to ask you about another one of these obstacles that seems to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to bother Christians, the idea that saying that humans have messed with the natural order, something like climate, obviously, is in some way acknowledging or some way insulting God's omnipotence. To say that, look, we're puny. How could we change the natural order of things? So believing then the fact that we're transforming something as crucial as the climate of the planet means that somehow you're taking God out of that. Talk about that, because this is something that a lot of Christians seem to worry about.
That is probably the biggest sticking point, I would say, for anybody who believes in God and believes in a sovereign God, that how could humans take over something which is essentially seen as God's domain? So, for example, there's verses in the Bible about how God has set the seasons in place and set the moon and the sun and the stars in place. And so people use that to say, well, you're saying that we won't have winter anymore, so there won't be any seasons anymore, so they're, you know, therefore we're taking over God's role. That's not the case at all. The seasons are caused by the orbit of the Earth around the sun. Humans are not affecting the orbit of the Earth around the sun, nor are we affecting the stars in the sky or the universe itself. So we are not affecting the things that are set up very clearly as, you know, God set them in place in the Bible. What we are doing is we're seeing the result of decisions that we've made. And we know when we look around this world that this world has been set up such that we have the freedom to make decisions that are good or bad. And when we make bad decisions, there are consequences. In fact, there are even verses in the Bible that talk about how we reap what we sow. And Paul even writes to the Corinthians and says, yes, quote, everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. So think before you make your choices, because not everything is a good choice. So with this issue of climate change, we didn't know back in the industrial era, we didn't know that burning all this coal and natural gas and oil would produce all this carbon. Now, by the 1800s, we did know. This science has been around for over 200 years. But, you know, back in the 1700s, we didn't know.
Yeah.
We didn't know that there was a side effect to this miraculous new energy source, but we know today. And so now we have the opportunity and the knowledge to make different choices.
You say that Christians need to remember that, as you put it in the book, we live in a fallen world. I mean, this is a crucial point for Christians that, you know, that... the earth fell. I mean, Adam and Eve fell. Mm-hmm. How does that plug into all of this?
Bad things happen to good people.
Yeah.
We know that. I mean, we all have examples of a pregnant mother who got cancer, you know, or a child who was run over by a drunk driver. I mean, things happen all the time in this world. Tragic consequences of choices that we as humans have the freedom to make. And so in that sense, we understand intuitively that our choices matter. And when there's 7 billion of us on this planet, when you can see the lights of our population from space, if you haven't seen those NASA photos, Google them, because the pictures of us from space are just amazing. We are so numerous that we do have the mass to move the planet now in terms of its climate.
The nature of God. This is an important thing, too, because I suppose some of this depends on what you believe to be the nature of God. This idea of God being omnipotent. As you say, he allows things to happen because he refuses to control us. I mentioned that earlier, that when it comes to climate change, we are the authors, as you say in the book, not God. How does this sort of idea of the nature of God, how does that fit into the way religious people believe things about climate change?
It's very interesting because I have found a strong correlation between people who believe very firmly in predestination and people who are utterly opposed to any suggestion that humans could alter climate. And I believe to a certain extent it goes with our personalities. If we feel that there has to be such tight control that God predicts our every step, our every conversation, the color of the car that we purchase, the type of breakfast cereal we eat in the morning, and certainly our job, our spouse, our house, and more important things in life. If we feel the need to have a God who tightly controls us like a marionette on strings, then that God is not consistent with the God that allows people to make choices that could lead to poor decisions and to consequences. So there is definitely some theology in this.
But you also reassure Christians in your book that God is still very intimately involved in the lives of his children, and that, as you put it in the book, it's perfectly possible that he may give us some help.
And in fact, if you look at natural factors, we would be getting a lot warmer today if it wasn't for the fact that we've been getting less energy from the sun over the last 40 years. So energy from the sun has been going down. In terms of the Earth's orbit, which determines when we head into the next ice age, we've been on that long, slow slide that got abruptly reversed in the industrial era. But the natural factors have been helping us out as much as they can. So, yes.
This is the so-called Maunder minimum. Is that right? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes, we had a grand minimum, actually, a few years ago.
Right.
But who knows? The energy from the sun could start going back up again. It's very erratic and random. You can't really predict it. So
you think God's helping a bit.
Oh,
who knows?
But I'm just saying the natural factors have been on our side the last few decades.
Well, and so why not reassure Christians? There's nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, like, maybe your prayers can help in that sense. I mean, I suppose that must be reassuring for Christians to hear that in the big scheme of things, things could make a difference.
It is. But I think that the Bible is very clear that our choices matter and that we have responsibility. Because people will say, well, you know, if this world is just going to end anyways, then, you know, hey, maybe this will just hasten the end of the world. But people were thinking the same way back in the Bible times. And so, for example, Paul again wrote to Thessalonians, and you have to love the Apostle Paul. He did not pull his punches. He wrote to them, and he basically said, get off your rear ends. He said, you're sitting around, you quit your jobs, you're just saying, oh, well, Christ will return tomorrow, so why do anything today? He said, get a job, support your family, care for the poor and the widows and the people who don't have enough food to eat. This is our job because we do not know what will happen in the future. And so in the same way, to just sit back in our easy chair, clasp our hands and say piously, I will pray about it, when we could actually be doing something about it, is not the Christianity that we believe. It is not the loving our neighbor. It is not the loving others as Christ loved us. Christ did not sit up there with his hands clasped, folded back, saying, I love you. He was out there with his sleeves rolled up, actually doing it.
Yeah.
And so that's what I believe we're called to do.
Religion isn't passive, then it's active.
Exactly.
Catherine Hayhoe, an atmospheric scientist, co-author of the book A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. She's coming out in just a couple of weeks with a new edition. We'll give you the particulars about that on our website. She's in Utah as a guest of the Utah Interfaith Power and Light and other sponsors, including the Nature Conservancy. Tonight at 7 o'clock, she's going to be speaking at the First Presbyterian Church in Salt Lake City. Tomorrow evening at 5, she's giving a talk at the Logan LDS Tabernacle. She's going to be back here in Salt Lake City for another talk on Thursday, and we'll give you the details again on our website. It's radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. Doug Fabrizio back now with atmospheric scientist and Christian Catherine Hayhoe. She's here in Utah, obviously, going to be giving a number of speeches. We'll have the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We're talking about sort of the religious case for doing something about climate change. Let's take a phone call from Dallas, who's joining us from Lehi, Utah. Dallas, welcome.
Hi, what a great topic. I really wanted to make a comment. If man has affected the climate or Earth, that somehow discredits God's role or makes him not as omnipresent. And I feel that that's a false thought there. I mean, in Genesis, it says that we're have dominion over all forms of life. So I feel like we are kind of in this with God to take care of this planet, this earth we have to exist and to live on.
This is a point you make in your book, this idea of dominion. Would you talk about that? Because it also implies this idea of responsibility. And I think to Dallas's point, that it is a partnership in some way.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that you brought that up, because in Genesis, it does say that God has given us responsibility for every living thing. So in a sense, if we believe the Bible, then we believe that God has handed us responsibility for the planet. So it's not infringing on God's domain. God has actually explicitly said, this is your home, keep it clean, take care of it. Now, the word dominion is a tricky one, though, because people have used it to be dominionists, in the sense of, we own everything on this planet, God has given it to us to do whatever we want to it. And if it is most expedient to run it into the ground, then so be it. But true dominion, of course, is not that. I mean, if you look at the CEO of a company and they run that company into the ground, what would we think of them? They would not be winning any awards for CEO of the year. If we look at a farmer or a rancher or producer who runs their land into the ground to the point where it can't produce anymore, what type of person is that? We know that dominionship refers to stewardship, to caretaking, to making sure that what we have been given will continue to sustain us and our children and our family for generations to come, just as it already has.
You say that you can find evidence, for example, and I'm wondering if it must be in Genesis, I suppose, because you say that God actually designed the world to be one of constant change.
It talks about that all through the Psalms, for example, of how there's amazing Psalms about science, about the weather, about the universe, about the stars. And of course, my dad, being a scientist and a person of faith, brought them all up from a young age.
Yeah.
But I think that nature and the world around us is part of how we see God when we look at something amazing. Interestingly, talking to many of my fellow scientists, some of whom would call themselves something, you know, they would call themselves Christian or LDS, but some of them would just call themselves spiritual people. And when you dig a bit deeper, or when they open up a bit more, they share that their sense of spirituality comes from nature, from an amazing mountain vista, or from that incredible time when they were out in the middle of nature, just surrounded by the world. And so I just feel like that is God speaking to us in ways that our heart can discern, even if we don't call it God.
Here is an email. It comes from Tyler, who says, I'm a liberal atheist who is very concerned about climate change, and I've struggled to find a way to talk to my religious family and friends about this. What approach do you recommend? People typically are not convinced by arguing, in my experience.
Oh, you are so right, Tyler. In fact, the number one thing not to do is to take all thousands of pages of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's reports, they're about a foot high by now, and just take them with you to family dinner and just throw them down the middle of the table beside the turkey. That's the last thing you should do. What I've found helps is two things. First of all, rather than arguing about the facts, connecting on the values. So even if you may not share your faith values with your family, even if you may not share your political values, they're family, and we do care about some of the same things. Even if it's as basic as being humans, living where we live in Salt Lake City or wherever it is that we are, we do care about some things. And so connecting on what we care about first, and then saying, let me share with you why I care about climate change. It's because of this value that you and I already share and already know is so important to us. That's the most important way to connect. The second thing I think that's helpful is the fact that there are so many voices of faith that are speaking out on this issue. So I work frequently with the National Association of Evangelicals. They have a wonderful booklet out about how caring for the least of these, the poor, is caring about climate change. The Pope is coming out with an encyclical for Catholics later this year. The LDS page has an environmental stewardship statement and video. I can't think of a single major denomination or religion that does not have leaders speaking out. And so, you know, Tyler, while you may not share your family's beliefs, whatever their beliefs are, I can almost guarantee you can find somebody who they share their beliefs with who is talking about this issue.
Caring for the poor is the mandate of Christianity, which was established 2,000 years ago, still holds.
Mm-hmm.
And a big one is this idea of caring for the poor. And not only that, as you say, that the effect of climate change on real people. And I just wanted to ask you about this because you mentioned the people of Colombia, in terms of the direct costs. You write about the people from the Arctic, the Kivalina. What's the name of the Inupiaq? Is that the people in the Arctic you write about?
That's as good a try as I would
make. Okay, good. All right.
Yes.
We'll leave it at that. But the point is, the people who have survived in the Arctic, the costs of relocating their villages, the effect and all of that. I mean, I guess the idea is to sort of really put a face to it, really put an actual...
Yeah. And part of the problem is that when you survey people and you say, what's the first image that pops into your head when you say climate change? Often it's the polar bear. If not, then it's Al Gore. And those are not the images that make us care about this issue as a humanitarian issue. So many people here go on missions, and I grew up myself as a missionary kid. And when you're on a mission, you're there to serve people, to help people, to do whatever you can to work with people, to serve their needs. Today, if we leave climate change out of the picture, our missions, our relief and development efforts, are like trying to fill a bucket with water, and that bucket has a hole in the bottom, and that hole is climate change, and it's getting bigger and bigger. We cannot ensure sufficient food for everybody on our planet. We can't ensure clean water, access to public health, or education if climate change continues unchecked. And those are not my words. That's coming from the Department of Defense, who views climate change as a threat multiplier and one that induces instability in states and nations that are already teetering on the edge.
Let's take a call from Jim in Salt Lake. Jim, hi.
Hello. Recently, recent months, Pat Robertson came out and admonished Christians to stop being so resistant to the idea that evolution or is incompatible with biblical creation story. I'm wondering if, number one, what effect that had on other Christians, and if there are Christian, specifically evangelical leaders who are either already have or are on the cusp of coming over onto the side of science in regard to climate change.
Well, you do write that there's a shift that seems to be going on among, among Christians. You want to talk about that?
Sure. First of all, on the issue of evolution, Francis Collins, who is the head of the National Institute of Health, who is also famed for decoding the human genome, no small feat.
Yeah, kind of a big deal.
Is an evangelical Christian and has written a wonderful book called Language of God, which I would encourage anybody to look up if they're interested. But as I said, we are seeing organizations like the National Association of Evangelicals. We are seeing the World Council of Churches. We are seeing leaders who are starting to recognize that this issue is real and it's here. And a large part of that, I think, is the fact that until recent years, you know, if you lived in the lower 48, it was hard to really put your finger on something that you could see happening. You know, if you were over in Africa working with people who are struggling through unprecedented drought, or if you're working in South Pacific Islands where people's homes are being flooded by rising sea level, or if you're even working along the Gulf Coast where they're experiencing stronger hurricanes, if you're working in those places, you see it. But for most of us in Middle America, we haven't seen it until recently. But now, here today, we're starting to see it. The drought in California. Droughts are part of life in California and here in Utah, but this drought has been exacerbated by climate change. There's more than 10 scientific papers just over the last year drawing that line. Our snowpack is shrinking. We can see it with our eyes. Our air quality is deteriorating for the simple fact that as it gets warmer, the chemical reactions happen faster that produce the ozone. So as we see these things happening, it's harder and harder to deny the evidence of our eyes. And that, I think, is part of why we as humans, not just Christians, but we as humans are starting to recognize, wow, hey, it is real. It's here. I can see it.
One of the things that you write about is that you mentioned Hebrews 11, for example. And in the Bible, it lays out the so-called heroes of the faith, Abraham and Noah and Moses and David and Samuel. And you say one of the things that was distinctive about all of them, or most of them anyway, is that they were people who faced up to the truth. Talk about that, if you would.
And who acted on their faith. In James, there's a verse that says, faith without works is dead. And it so bothered Martin Luther that he was considering maybe it shouldn't be part of the Bible.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think what it was saying is, if it is faith, then it will result in works. And so, you know, when I first started to talk to people about climate change, I didn't really see that as an expression of my faith. I just saw that as kind of my responsibility as a scientist. But I've started to realize that, you know, this is the world God created. These are the people who we are to love. And it is an expression of our faith when we see something happening to stand up and say, this is the issue that we have, and here's what our values have to say about it. So let's roll up our sleeves and do something.
You feel optimistic. I mean, we mentioned that shift that you think is going on. Do you feel, I think you even put it this way, a tide turning in some way among people of faith in this country?
I feel a tide turning in certain places. I feel it turning generationally. The younger generation is so much more open to this. I was just at a very conservative evangelical college in upstate New York. Very small, tiny little college, 1,200 students. So, you know, the size of an average high school in a big city. They are putting in the largest solar array of any college in the United States. And they have a stewardship director. And I gave talks and classes across campus, and the students were so engaged. And this was a conservative evangelical community. So we see it happening generationally. But I'll tell you, we also see it happening in our cities. One of the things that makes me the most encouraged and the most excited is when I hear about what cities are doing about climate change. Here in Salt Lake City, you guys have an amazing sustainability team who are thinking every day about how to improve the quality of the life of everybody who lives here and make Salt Lake City a better and healthier and more enjoyable place to live. And that's really what this is about. It's not about addressing climate change and leaving all our other concerns behind. It's about the fact that we live in communities that are often isolated in suburbia, where we drive long distances rather than connecting in communities with our neighbors. We're eating food that isn't very healthy. We're, you know, our lifestyles just aren't very healthy. And so by fixing many problems at the same time, as well as increasing our energy independence and working on our air quality, we're also addressing climate change. And so it's like a win, 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 not a win on climate and lose on everything else.
Catherine Hayhoe, she directs the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University, co-author of A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. She's giving a number of addresses while she's here in Utah, and you can get the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Catherine Hayhoe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.